Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace. It's the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. It's finally getting a little bit warmer here in Poland. It's been a really long winter, it feels like. Even though we're in May now, it's still pretty cold outside. But, you know, there are pros and cons to everything, so that just means colder weather still means more time for programming, right?
Exactly. And it's the opposite here, where it's too warm for fall, basically. So, I'm waiting. It looks like things are changing because as I was getting down here to the office to record, I saw some quite menacing clouds in the distance.
Better run inside and fire up Xcode, right?
Exactly.
So before we begin with our topics for this episode, which we have some really fun topics to talk about, I do believe we have some follow-up, right? Which follow-up is like trademark, copyright, John Syracusa. You're supposed to say that, right? When you use that term.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's up? We've received some audience feedback.
Exactly. Yeah, so I want to thank Paul and Frank, who both suggested a solution to my package resolution problems I was having in Xcode. So to recap, I told about an issue I was having where Xcode would just fail to resolve dependencies randomly, and it would say that there was something wrong with Git authentication, and there was a button to resolve it, and it didn't do anything. And apparently there is a hidden default flag, as there usually is to solve this sort of issue. So we're going to leave a link in the show notes, but it's defaults write com.apple.td.xcode.id package support use built-in SCM. Yes. So if you run that, it will, I guess, use like a copy of Git that Xcode ships with, and it's not affected by your global settings or whatever. And yeah, it just fixes it. And I haven't had those issues since I ran that command. So thanks a lot, Paul and Frank, for suggesting this fix.
That is actually bringing up, I think, a really interesting kind of common problem when it comes to kind of dynamic linking, or in this case, invoking command line tools that exist on the system, where when you're building a tool that is then using other tools or linking to system libraries or something that is supposedly present on the user's machine, that has some pros and cons, right? When you don't have to bundle an additional copy, even though it seems like they're doing this in this case anyway. So it kind of brings up the question as why are they not always just using that bundled version of Git if they are already shipping with it to begin with? Because in general, like, the advantage of using a shared system library or invoking a installed command line tool kind of globally on the user system is that you don't have to ship your own copy.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff on macOS where the actual binary, if you look in like user bin, it's a shim that kind of calls xc run whatever to try to find the actual thing inside Xcode or the command line tools that you can install separately if you don't want to have Xcode. And apparently Git is not one of those. So yeah, but Xcode ships with its own copy of Git. So it's a bit complicated, but I mean, at least it's working now. So I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, that's great. And it's really nice also that there is a setting, even though it's hidden, to actually, you know, fix the problem. Of course, the best would be if all the settings would be somewhere in the UI where you could just find them or like fix them with some kind of error button, you know, in the error message and so on. But yeah, in this case, it was a classic defaults write that solved the problem. Like you said, in so many other cases with Xcode.
And with many other things as well.
Right, exactly.
So, John, what do you have for us? I know you've been working on something very interesting, and I've seen some screenshots, and I know you probably are not able to share those yet, but I am very interested in what you've been working on because it's a very complicated piece of engineering, in my opinion, and I would love to hear more about it.
Sure, absolutely. So What I've been working on is for the last year and a half, I've been working on an app, essentially like a product that ships across Mac and Windows. So it's a cross-platform project.
So you're using Electron.
Of course. Yeah. That's what you use for cross-platform apps, right? No, it's written in Rust, which is, you know, I spoke about using Rust on previous episodes since our reboot here on Stacktrace. But Rust has really become my favorite programming language for kind of cross-platform things, whether it's like embedding like what you would previously perhaps use C++ for as like a shared library for native applications, or in this case, like writing a single code base that just runs across platforms. So typically that's something you would use something like web technologies for. But, you know me, Rambo, and a lot of our listeners probably also know that I think the web, you know, the web technologies have a good place on the web, but I'm not the biggest fan of just using them everywhere. I think there's definitely a lot of downsides to using something like Electron or other technologies that use web tech to build cross-platform apps, right? I do really want that nice native experience. And in this particular case, since I am using Rust and I'm not using Swift or I guess like C# or something on Windows, like to create two separate apps that are then using something like a Rust library for the shared logic, I'm actually writing the entire app in Rust. That means that I have to find ways to kind of interface with the system and build the app that way, which, again, has a kind of pros and cons. Like if you're building something with the native toolchains, you have direct access to all the native APIs. But if you're building something with any kind of layer of abstraction, whether it's like web tech or whether it's like some kind of cross-platform UI library in another language, or in my case, I'm actually drawing the UI directly using the GPU. Ooh. So it's kind of low-level programming in that way. And I will talk a little bit more soon about why that is. But that's kind of the general setup for the project. It's a Rust-based project, and it's a cross-platform, and I am drawing the UI on the GPU. And the reason that I've created this technical setup is because I really need this project to be using as few resources as possible. It needs to be as efficient as possible, and it needs to be as fast as possible. So that means that use as little RAM and VRAM as possible and be as fast as possible. And I mean, in general, I would say when I'm writing code, I try to use resources as efficiently as I can, right? Like I'm trying to not make my code super slow or like overuse memory. But in this case, because of the kind of environment that I'm working on here, I need it to be very, very efficient. It's very important. And I'm being kind of vague here as what the product is by itself. And it's not because I'm scared that like someone will copy it or something like that. It's more because I don't really want to announce the product at this point, right? Because I don't know quite yet what I want to do with it. I mentioned I've been working on it for like 1.5 years. It's kind of a side project, so it's not my main work or anything. But I do have it in closed beta already. So there are people using it, including myself. I'm using it almost every day. And I will share soon what it is, but not today. We will talk about some of the technical details, but we won't talk about exactly what the product is. I will leave that as a little bit of a cliffhanger, a secret for a future episode.
Well, we do know it's something cross-platform that needs to be very good about resource usage, and apparently there's some sort of UI for it, and you use it every day, so people can try to guess what it is, but yeah, and think about what the things John likes to do.
And the things I would use Windows for specifically, right?
Oh, yeah, I didn't want to go there. I thought it was too obvious, but hey. So yeah, I think that's fascinating because I've never done it myself, but I have touched projects that have that sort of cross-platform integration. And it's always very interesting to see what people are doing to achieve that. Like one project that comes to mind is WebKit, right? Because WebKit works pretty much everywhere. So you can find in there all of the Apple side of things where it does like UIKit or AppKit, but you also have cross-platform stuff for Windows and Linux and whatnot. So how did you decide basically you have choices as to where you draw the abstraction line, basically. And in your case, you chose to go down to the GPU level for UI. And I think that's the level that gives you the most flexibility, but it's also the level that gives you the most work. So how did you come up with that decision?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I've been experimenting with different ways of interfacing with the GPU. So I've done an implementation using something called WGPU, which is a kind of implementation of the web GPU standard, but it's using the native kind of drivers and native rendering frameworks on each platform. So it would be Metal on macOS and DirectX on, or Vulkan if you want, on Windows. And I've also then been experimenting with more higher level tools, like one of the initial versions of this product, the currently shipping, quote unquote, shipping version of it that is in beta, in closed beta, is using something called Raylib, which is much more higher level. It's more kind of on the same level of abstraction as Core Graphics, where you can like draw shapes and draw labels and, you know, things that draw gradients. And it includes kind of all those things in the toolbox, so you're not directly interfacing with the GPU. And now the current version that I'm working on, it's using SDL. So we talked about it on a previous episode, how I've been, you know, integrating SDL. So this is the project that I've been integrating it into. So I think I will probably ship the SDL implementation, because the WGPU one, it is really nice to like directly work on directly towards the GPU to have all that power and that like lowest latency. But SDL, I feel like, strikes a nice balance where I can do everything like GPU accelerated and draw directly, but I don't have to like manage all of the pipeline state and all the differences between the platforms and everything like that manually myself, because that's not quite the level that I need to work on for this project. I do want the UI and all the drawing I do to be fully GPU accelerated, but I don't need to do a lot of like advanced shader work and these sorts of things. So I just need it to be fast and lightweight as possible. So not like, you know, a whole other UI layer on top or something like that, but, you know, it should go straight to the GPU. But I'm finding SDL, which is a cross-platform library, very, very commonly used for all sorts of drawing, including games and custom UIs and things like that, like any kind of GPU accelerated drawing. And it's been around for a long time. And there's a new version 3, which is relatively new, which I'm using. And I think that strikes like the nicest balance for me, where I can focus on what I want to focus on. I don't need to like manage a whole bunch of complexity that I don't really need to worry about. But at the same time, I get like really, really good performance out of what I'm building.
Right. So what does SDL provide you that you are actually using in this case? Is it just like the surface where you draw your own stuff?
Yeah, so you get like a canvas from SDL that you can draw on. And essentially what you just do there is you can draw like textures, which means, you know, images. You can draw rectangles and you can draw text. That's about it. And then the rest you have to kind of build on top of that yourself, right? And you can then either use like custom shaders if you want to draw shapes and, you know, rounded rectangles and these sorts of things. You can use textures for that. You can, for example, generate textures that you then put together to create the shapes you want and gradients and all sorts of things, right? But that's like, it's a pretty low level in that sense that you don't get all of that additional toolbox that you would get from something like Core Graphics or Raylib that I was using before. If I want to draw a gradient now, I have to like either do like a shader for it, or in my case, what I'm doing for gradients is I'm generating a texture on the fly, caching that texture, uploading it to the GPU, and then drawing that in a rectangle to generate like a linear gradient.
Right.
So that's the sort of abstraction level that I'm working on right now. But what I get from SDL otherwise is I get window management cross-platform, which is really nice. I get input handling, which is really nice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, keyboard, mouse, all that kind of stuff. You know, the general kind of running of the application. So I can focus on like all of the drawing code, all of the logic of the app itself, without having to like manage that entire kind of window pipeline, GPU state pipeline, and so on. Like that's all taken care of for me.
So would you say, to make Apple developers more familiar with it, would it be at the level of something like, imagine you have something like Core Foundation and maybe a little bit of Core Animation and that's it, basically.
Yeah,
that's,
I think core animation is too high level. Core graphics is also too high level. Like, it provides you with too many great tools, which is like basically what I am trying to build myself now on top of STL, which we're kind of getting to here. Like, the topic itself, what I want to talk about today, is kind of how I'm using that then to build my own kind of UI abstraction. Because one of the mistakes I made early in this project when I was just getting started, when it was very much in the prototyping phase, was that I was writing all of my UI directly using the GPU abstraction, which meant that, you know, when I had something like a list view or like an, you know, image view or grid or something, I was just like computing the rectangles and, you know, loading the texture, sending them to the GPU, like, you know, drawing it that way in the view layer. And as you can probably imagine, that became very hard to maintain very quickly. Where it's like, you know, doing manual layouts in UIKit with frames is like much, much easier than what I was doing, right? And even like doing something like core animation, where you have already like the frames and the bounds and the transforms and the, you know, shape layers, gradient layers, all the stuff. Like, I was not at all working on that level of abstraction. I was working much, much more lower level than that. And it just meant that since I didn't have that clean separation between the app itself and the kind of rendering layer, the UI kind of drawing layer, it became very, very messy, like classic spaghetti code.
So in terms of layout, since you're working on a UI framework, you, of course, need to have a layout model. And there are several different ways to express layout in code and behavior. So you can do something like what SwiftUI does, where things propose a size to their children and things like that. You can have something like layout constraints or manual frames. What are you doing in terms of layout for your framework?
Yeah, that's really kind of the core question, I think. Like, when you're building any kind of UI library or UI framework or any kind of like layout engine or something, you kind of want to decide what kind of model you want to use, right? Like you mentioned, you can use like different kinds of overall models. And I would say that the SwiftUI layout model, which is very similar to the CSS Flexbox model, right? I would say that is currently my favorite way of doing things. Like, I really love working with SwiftUI. The frustrations I have with SwiftUI is not so much about the layout system. It's more about the API limitations sometimes, right? And sometimes when it's producing results that are counterintuitive, let's say, or at least for me. But the model itself, like using stacks and spacers and using modifiers and, you know, using padding to then inset your bounds, having that model where if you have a stack, the total size of the stack is the total size of its children, like you have spacing in a stack, alignment, like all of that stuff, like I really, really like, right? And that's the same thing you will find in Flexbox and probably in Jetpack Compose 2 on Android, I believe. Like, it's a kind of modern layout model that I think works for most things that you want to do with layout, right? Like, it's a very nice kind of layout abstraction or layout system to use. So that's what I'm using. But the cool thing, so kind of when anytime you're building something like this, which is like you're building something very custom and sort of low level instead of using something ready-made, because of course, in Rust, there's a lot of cross-platform UI libraries too that are native that I could have used. There is all sorts of layout algorithms that I could have used. There's, for example, a really great project called Clay, which is like a C library for layout.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
It's just a header file, right?
Yeah, exactly. And also, one really cool thing about Clay is the creator of it, Nick Barker, he has a lot of YouTube videos about how he made it. And in fact, there is one called How Clay's UI Layout Algorithm Works on YouTube, which we'll put a link to in the show notes, that was a big inspiration for me when I started building this. Like, that's kind of what, when I watched that, I was like, huh, it turns out this, it's not so complicated as I thought. You know, I can probably do this. It kind of gave me the confidence to at least start prototyping and get started. Because when you hear something like building your own layout engine, it's something that sounds just like impossibly complicated, right? Like, it just sounds like, you know, there's no way I could build SwiftUI or anything like it by myself. Like, it requires a team of 100 people. But it really isn't something like that. And it, of course, it depends a lot on what you want your layout system to be. But in my case, you know, always when we're deciding, you know, do I go for like a ready-made tool or something someone else made? Or do I build something myself? Like, the trade-off there is that if you go with something ready-made, it will probably save you a lot of time. You will probably also like have something that is more mature and has solved a lot more edge cases than you might solve yourself. But if you're building something on your own, and this I would say goes for not just layout systems, like anything, you can customize it exactly how you want, right?
Yeah.
And you can build only the parts that you need and only the parts that you want, and you can make them work the way you want them to work, which is kind of really crucial for this particular project. Because like I mentioned, I have some pretty strong constraints about performance and about like, you know, using system resources. And it doesn't mean that, you know, I am the best programmer and I can create a layout system that is the most efficient one ever made. No, but what I can do is that I can optimize it for my specific use case, right? And that means that I can integrate it like perfectly in a way that, you know, my app and this layout system, it just works hand in hand, right? Yeah. So that's kind of been my focus.
Yeah, performance always involves trade-offs. So if you have a completely generalized UI framework, like take Swift UI, for example, that has to work on Vision OS all the way down to Watch OS and even Mac OS, it has to have different trade-offs and optimizations that are not necessarily going to work in every situation. But since you're making this specifically for your particular product and the problem you want to solve, you can have optimizations that are designed specifically to the needs of your own product. And they would probably not work at all if I took your framework and tried to do something completely different with it. But since you are your own client and only client, you can take those shortcuts, let's say, and have optimizations that, oh, if I wanted to have this other feature, I would not be able to have this optimization. But since I don't need that, I get to have this optimization. And that's something you do not get with a ready-made, generalized framework that you get from a third party, because they are trying to make something that everyone basically can use for anything.
Exactly. And also when you're optimizing and you're like profiling your app and you really want to like fine-tune specific hot code paths, like having control of the entire stack is so helpful, yeah, because it means that I can go in and I can make specific optimizations where I specifically need it. Like, let's say, just for the sake of an example, that I am drawing a lot of VStacks, right? And the VStacks, they have this layout computation in them that is repeated, you know, thousands of times throughout the application. Well, I can go in and add like a specific caching just for that if I need to, right?
Yeah.
And then just speed up that specific operation, which is not something that a general purpose layout tool would want to do, because you, in general, you don't want to like fill an open source project with specific optimizations for specific use cases, right? Because that just pollutes the code base and makes it super complicated. So again, it's like the trade-off of, you know, having more control, but also, of course, having to write a lot of the implementation. So going back to your original question there about the like which kind of layout kind of model to use here. So I am using something very similar to Swift UI in that I'm having that model where I start with the size of the window itself, and then I'm asking the root view like, which size do you want to be, and it looks at its children and asks that question, you know, goes down recursively and computes the layout. And then I have a pretty nice caching layer throughout, so I can cache like layouts on different levels, so that if a view hasn't changed and I don't need to redraw it and recalculate it and so on, so I can make things again as efficient as possible. But also, like, I made some pretty different decisions also sometimes compared to Swift UI. And this is also, I think, an interesting thing to talk about. It's like, you know, again, when you're building something on your own, you can also like use your own opinions, because you will always, like, when you're using someone else's tool, whether it's Swift UI or an open source library or whatever, they will make decisions that you might not always agree with, right? Or you will find not super intuitive or not the way you would like it to work. So one thing I've always wished that Swift UI would have is a way for a view to say, I want to be as wide or as tall as my parent. Mm. And in Swift UI, you can either only say, like, you know, you can maximize the size, right? You can say, you know, you can do things like minimum width or maximum width, or you can do infinity, right? You can have a, like a HDAC with a spacer in it, and that will grow infinitely and fill like all the available space. But in Swift UI, there's no really built-in way to express I want this particular view to be the same size as my parent.
Well, before everyone sends us emails about this, there is a newer API. I don't know if it's 26 right. or 18, that's like container relative frame or something. And
yes, exactly.
You get a closure where you can like do like a multiplier, for example. So there is that, but it's a bit of a hack, basically.
Yes, and there's also the way where you can set like max width infinity on, for example, a view inside of a VStack, and then you can set the VStack size to fixed, like fixed width true, and that will also achieve the same effect, but with some potential downsides. But my point is that there is no like, it's not a first class layout concept in SwiftUI. You have all these extra things built on top of it that they don't really feel like their first class components of the layout engine, right? That concept. So that's something I built in. So I built in that you can set a view to have a maximizing width or height or a flexible width and height. And flexible means essentially match the parent. So it's just an example of how when you're building something on your own, you can also tailor it like to what you how you want things to work. So now when I'm, you know, defining, for example, a label that has like some kind of shape under it, like an underline, I can just, that underline, I can just set the width to be flexible, not maximizing, and it will just fill the parent container. So, you know, it's just a little example of, you know, how you can kind of tweak things to your liking also when you're building something on your own.
You mentioned the fixed size thing in SwiftUI. So I've actually managed to crash the Windows server on macOS once using that because on the Mac, you have a window, let's say, and but it's not bound to be as, let's say, have its height limited by the height of your Mac's display because Windows can go out of the display. That's perfectly legal on macOS.
Yeah.
It depends on the window style mask and things like that, but it doesn't matter in this case. So I had like a text inside a window and I used fixed size. I don't remember vertical, horizontal, whatever, but it basically tried to make the window have an infinite height and the window server did not like that at all. And it just crashed my Mac. So yeah, be careful.
Exactly. Be careful with your constraints and be careful with your frame modifiers as well, right?
Yeah. So one more thing I would love to hear about is the Rust language itself. And are there any specific features of the Rust language that you think are particularly good or maybe that are not particularly good for solving this particular problem?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that Rust has become like my favorite way to do like cross-platform development these days instead of using something like JavaScript or C++ or something. And I know there's also Swift now. You can do Swift, of course, on Apple's platforms and on Android and on Windows. But it's really great that you can do that. And I really like appreciate everyone who's working on that, like in the open source community and so on. But I think like other ecosystems like Go and Rust and so on, they're so far ahead of Swift in this kind of context because they were built from the beginning to be kind of open source and cross-platform in that sense. So the package ecosystem and everything of Rust is like so rich when it comes to anything that has to do with like cross-platform development, like basic things like file system and async stuff and, you know, all those things like accessing specific folders, like on macOS, you want to get the home folder and on Windows, you want to get like the app data folder or something. Like all of that stuff is, there are libraries for all of that and they're like really, really stable and mature and so on. So yeah, it's that's like a very big reason I think to choose Rust for something like this, like something that is cross-platform, whether it's a internal kind of core library of an app or something like a cross-platform application that you still want it to be native and fast. The language itself, like, I think is a bit of an acquired taste. And I've shared some interesting Rust syntax with you, Rambo, that I think you've had kind of a visceral reaction to.
You said it's an acquired taste. I would say it's a metallic taste.
Right, exactly. I think, like, Rust syntax, like once you get used to it, it focuses a lot on being very explicit, which I think is a kind of noble goal because sometimes, you know, having implicit behavior, whether it's like something in Swift where you can say, you can access a property without using self, right? You can say, you don't have to use self dot, you can just access the property name. That's nice and convenient. It reduces verbosity in the code, But, you know, it also adds some ambiguity sometimes. And when you're just reading code on GitHub in a pull request, sometimes it's hard to tell. Is this a property or a local variable, right? Or a static variable, because there's no difference in Swift.
Or even global variable.
Exactly, yeah. And Rust makes all of those things, like, you have to be explicit about everything. So that means that the syntax is way more verbose. That's why I mean it's like more of an acquired taste, like, especially if you're coming from Swift, where everything is kind of focusing on being lightweight. Rust also has a fairly lightweight syntax in many ways. It's modern. It doesn't feel like unnecessarily cumbersome, like, and doesn't feel old, but it's definitely way more verbose than Swift in most regards. And it focuses a lot on being explicit, which has a lot of benefits. So when it comes to building something like this, that meant that I had to come up with an API that doesn't use something like, you know, result builders or any of those features that we have in Swift, which again is like, it's pros and cons, where Swift has so many features that are so tailor-made for specific use cases, like result builders, right? They're like a specific language feature for a specific thing that if we want to build this specific type of functionality. Rust doesn't have much of that stuff. It focuses more on being kind of very consistent and simpler in a way, like when it comes to the language features. So I don't have access to something like result builders, and it wouldn't really feel idiomatic even if there was some way to hack that in, because you want to follow the conventions of the language you're working in, right? Like, you don't want to be the person who's like using Java conventions in Swift, right? Because that just it just ends up being a mess, hard for people to read and understand, and, you know, doesn't feel well integrated. So what I'm doing mostly is that I'm using also like closure-based API, because there is also closures in Rust, just like there is in Swift. But instead of having like a result builder where you can just like say vstack, open up a closure, and then say text, image, text, spacer, like in Swift, I instead say vstack and you get like a UI builder in your closure, and I just call that variable always UI. And then you can say UI.text, UI.spacer, UI.image. So the syntax ends up being quite lightweight. And once you see that UI pattern everywhere, like it feels pretty consistent, I will say. So I think I've done a fairly okay job with like building a fairly lightweight API that is still, it fits in with the kind of overall Rust model. I could have in Rust also used macros, because there is a way to do like kind of code generation using macros, and some libraries do that to reduce the verbosity. I am maybe considering doing something like that, but for now I think just using closures and API calls, method calls on a builder works. It's kind of exactly the same as a result builder. It's just that you are being, again, more explicit instead of having that implicitly taken care of for you.
Right. Yeah, that sounds great. And as much as you mentioned my reaction to the syntax, it's not too bad. It's just that I am not familiar with Rust. Like, if you show someone a Swift file with lots of at main actor, at escaping, whatever, and generics everywhere, if they don't know Swift, they will find it horrible as well. So it's not, it's common for us to feel this way about syntaxes we're not familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. You always have to like first like really familiarize yourself with the syntax of a language or a platform or something. And then you kind of, when you have that fluency, it's much easier to just like read the details directly without having to, like, the syntax kind of disappears. Like you're just reading the code at that point.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention one or two final things before we move on to your topic, Rambo. And the first also like nice thing that I found about building my own kind of layout system and UI framework from the beginning is I can also add all sorts of tooling that I need and that I find useful myself. Mm-hmm. Like, one thing that I still love to do is the old-fashioned classic border debugging when it comes to UI development, where you just like set red border, blue border, green border on different views to be able to see their frames, right? Right. When I'm working on an iOS app or Mac app, whatever, I'm using that all the time. I even have like a Xcode snippet for like assigning a border to a layer of a view, just because I do it so often during debugging. But the cool thing is, now that I have my whole rendering stack that I fully control, I can just have like a flag that I can set and say like draw borders true, and it just like in the rendering code, whenever it draws a view, it just draws a red border around it.
Nice.
So that's like, that's something I could easily build myself, and I can build all sorts of kind of tooling. I even also added a JSON mode where I can press like F1 on the keyboard, and that takes the current view hierarchy and the kind of metrics for it, and it writes it to a JSON file, and then it starts observing it. And then if I change the JSON file and save it, it just refreshes the layout.
Nice.
So that means that I can very quickly iterate on metrics and colors and gradients and these sorts of things, which has been really great. So I can sort of build tooling like that as well, very easily on top, which I find fun to do also.
Sounds good.
And then the final thing, we talked about AI on a previous episode.
Oh.
And this has also been an area where AI has been very useful for me when I've wanted to do specific kinds of rendering. Let's say, for example, when I was implementing shadows, like that was a thing where I have no idea how to draw a shadow, right? Like it's something that you take for granted when you use Apple's platforms or something, right? Like, or CSS, you just said drop shadow, yes, please. And this many pixels and this color and this intensity, and it just draws it for you. And this was something where I could iterate quite quickly. I didn't just like ask Claude Code or something to build it and paste it into my project. I just rarely work that way. I like to understand the code that I put into my projects, but I used it a lot for iterations and for ideation. And, can you show me a couple of different algorithms that I could use to draw shadows? And it showed me some things and I tried different things. And then I also did a thing where I created a view with a shadow in Sketch, and I exported it as a PNG. And I asked Claude Code how it would recreate this with an algorithm, and it just came up with an algorithm for it. It like reverse engineered the image, right? The pixels. And then I also like could use that to kind of tweak my algorithm and, eventually end up with something that I think looks really good. It was just another like cool use case of AI when you have a problem that you haven't really solved ever before in your career, or like you didn't have to solve it before because shadows has always been taken care of for me, but now I'm doing it myself. So now I had to, come up with a way to do it, and using AI for that, like just for coming up with some ideas and tweaking algorithms and so on that I was working on, was really, really helpful.
But the most important thing I want to know about your UI framework, and I think many listeners want to know as well, I don't want to know if you have the ability to draw rounded rectangles. I want to know if your framework can draw squircles. Can it squircle? That is the question.
It can absolutely squircle. So that's the only way. Like, is there really a round rect, right? Like it's squircles or nothing, right?
Exactly.
Well, I'm doing kind of like, it's sort of... It's not just a simple round rect. It's more like a squircle, but it's not fully. It's like, it's one of those where you can kind of change the algorithm and the anti-aliasing of the algorithm also to have different results, right? Like if you want it to be more kind of circly, like how you want the, how do you call it? Like the angle of how it kind of changed into a circle from a straight line. Like
right.
How you want to, you can tweak that in so many different ways. So it's one of those things. I haven't created like a general purpose solution that anyone could use in any app. I've just created something that looks nice for the UI I want to build.
Right. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure the technical term for squircle is a super ellipse. So I love that name. Super ellipse sounds like super interesting. But as long as it works and it doesn't look ugly, I'm fine with it.
That's the goal, right? That's all we're trying to do in life, Rambo, is just build something that works and that is not ugly. Okay, so that's been a kind of deep dive into building your own UI framework. Again, I'm hoping to share more about the project itself soon. And of course, if any listeners have any specific questions about like, what it's like to building something like this kind of project, like a kind of GPU-accelerated cross-platform UI library, please reach out. And I would love to, share more details on future episodes. But now I've talked a lot about all the stuff I've been doing. So now I want to hear more, Rambo, about what you've been doing. So what have you been up to?
So I've been up to, for quite a while, actually doing work related to virtualization on Apple Silicon. Are you familiar with that, John?
I am familiar with that. I am familiar with another an app in the Buddy universe called Virtual Buddy.
Exactly. I haven't done a lot of work in VirtualBuddy for a while because I've been focusing on other more pressing things. But I think it's really interesting the fact that Apple, shortly after introducing Apple Silicon, they introduced the built-in virtualization framework. And for those who don't know, and you can actually watch a WWDC video and learn how you can make an app like VirtualBuddy, basically, because they make it quite easy for you to just create a virtual machine and run a virtualized Mac or even Linux desktop on your Mac. And I wanted to talk about it because I think it says a lot about the direction things are going, and also because I think virtualization is very useful for security research and for testing in general. Like in my case, I have apps that support previous versions of macOS. And for some of them, like AirBuddy, for example, I can't really do full end-to-end testing on a virtual machine because it requires Bluetooth and wireless stuff that doesn't work in a virtual machine. But I can definitely test UI things in a virtual machine to see if like this new UI I built works normally in macOS 14 or something. So that's a really good use. But also for security research, you can have a macOS virtual machine, for example, and you can tweak boot args and disable system integrity protection and basically hack it however you want without doing it on a real machine, which you should never do on your production Mac that you are logged in with your Apple account. But not many people have the budget to have a separate spare hacking Mac that they can just hack. And also, let's say you do something bad and you can maybe even break the hardware if you do something really bad. So yeah, I think it's a really interesting area to research on the Mac.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of like the use case there you mentioned, being able to test on earlier macOS versions is sort of giving you an iOS simulator for the Mac, right?
Right.
Like when we're doing iOS development, we're so used to being like, oh, let me run this on iOS 26. Let me now run it on iOS 18. Let me run like five simulators at the same time. Let me check like iPad versus iPhone. But on the Mac, before virtualization, it really wasn't easy to do, right? Like you really had to have separate Macs that you would test on when doing Mac development, which is, you know, really complex and expensive. So being able to do all of that kind of virtualization work and spinning up like different versions to reproduce a bug or to check the layout or to, you know, check different system APIs and fallbacks and so on, like super useful, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting that you touched on simulators because I think it's also important to try to differentiate, like, because you have different ways of running something inside of something else. And you have the classic emulation,
right,
which is when you have a piece of software that is trying to emulate some hardware and it's trying to run the same instructions, basically, that some other hardware will run. But instead of running on real hardware, it's creating that hardware using software. So that's emulation.
Yeah, or it's like hot patching specific things and rerouting specific things to other native implementations. Like, for example, I've been doing a lot of PC gaming on Android. There is like this really cool app that you can use called Game Native, which uses some tech from Valve, I believe, to like as a translation layer. And it will literally like take like instructions meant for like Windows games and then but then run them with the native kind of rendering tools on Android, or, you know, on it also works on Linux and so on. So it will not just emulate like all the instructions, because that can be very, very slow, mm-hmm. but it will take like specific instructions and like send them to the native implementations for those things, like whether it's drawing or input handling or whatever.
Yeah, or something like the classic Wine.
Wine is not an emulator, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because I don't think that's technically emulation, but it's basically shimming, right?
Right, shimming. Yeah, that's a good one.
It shims system API. But yeah, it's yet another way to run something inside of something else. And there's also virtualization, on the other hand, which is a much more native thing. So when you run a macOS virtual machine on Apple Silicon, the processor is actually running that Mac OS version and everything inside of it as if it's running on a real Mac, but it's not emulating anything. It's running on real hardware and it gets access to your real hardware. But of course, for certain functionality, it is piped through the host operating system because there are things such as networking, for example, where you don't have a Wi-Fi card on the virtual Mac. You have either a NAT or a bridged network, which then has to talk to the kernel on the host in order to do networking stuff. And
right.
Guess what? How do they do that? There is a kernel extension inside of macOS that supports this virtualized hardware. So it's not magic. It's all in the kernel. And one thing that I like to talk about also is people, I get a lot of, so I don't have issues enabled in the VirtualBuddy repo. We've talked at length about that before, but I have discussions because I really like that. So people can post things and other people can help them or I can help them. And there are some bug reports in there and that's perfectly fine. So I like the discussions model on GitHub.
Yeah, I think when we talked about it in the past, like one of the biggest issues we had with issues, very meta, was the naming, right? Like that it just implies that you go to an open source project and you open an issue and it's kind of like a support, right? Like you're requesting support. And depending on the open source project, that's not always the dynamic that the author or maintainer wants to have with the users, right? Like, yeah. You know, that I'm providing customer support for you for free for this project I created for free in my spare time, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, discussions, I think, is a much more productive and a great addition to GitHub.
Right. And a very frequent topic in VirtualBuddy's discussions are issues related to installation of macOS in virtual machines. And it's very hard to convey exactly why things work the way they work without explaining a really long list of very complex things. Because what Apple has done with Mac virtualization is when you boot up a virtual machine, a virtualized Mac virtual machine, lots of virtual things in here. When you do that, you basically get on the host Mac, if you look in the system information panel, you have a new USB device connected, which is a Mac in DFU mode. So they do the entire restoration process exactly as if it were a real device. And it does everything. So you have the IPSW, it will read the build manifest, find the build identity for that particular Mac, quote-unquote, hardware, which is a virtual machine. VMA2 macOS AP is the board code for it. And it will do the TSS signing that every Apple hardware device has to do when you restore it. And it will do all of that process, but instead of it being a real hardware, it's a virtual machine. But from the point of view of everything, it's just a Mac that you are restoring from DFU mode. And that's why, for example, we are close to WWDC. When Apple ships macOS 27, the first beta, if you try to install that beta using VirtualBuddy in your macOS 26 host, you will get an error message. And I've done a lot of work in VirtualBuddy to actually detect the situation that triggers that error message so that I can actually explain to the user, hey, here's what you have to do. Because since the system recognizes the VM as if it were a real hardware, your Mac does not have the system libraries with the version that it needs to know how to restore a virtual machine to macOS 27, because it's right. Like it's a real Mac.
It's from the future.
Exactly. So you've probably seen, if you like take an iPhone running iOS 26 and you plug it into a Mac running macOS 14 or something, Finder will pop up a window, hey, your Mac needs a software update to be able to talk to this iPhone or restore this iPhone. So that's the same thing. And Apple they do a meh job of providing a separate package that you can download from the Apple Developer Downloads folder, downloads page. It's like a DMG, a fairly small DMG that installs the necessary system libraries. But Xcode will also do that. So if you download the Xcode 27 beta, you know, when you first launch a new version of Xcode, it does like installing system components. Those are the system components it's installing, among other things that it also installs through that process. And another issue that pops up sometimes is if you try to install, let's say, a random beta version of macOS 26.2 point whatever that was released a few months ago, you may get an error where it says something like, this version is not authorized to run on this machine or something like that. And that happens when Apple has stopped signing that particular version of macOS. And they don't stop signing major releases because that's allowed. You can restore older major releases. But some specific builds of macOS, they will stop signing. So I actually built a whole server that will take the URL to an IPSW. It will extract the build manifest and it will perform the request that macOS normally performs to sign a macOS update or restore image and check if Apple is signing that version.
Ooh, that's
which
cool.
VirtualBuddy then uses in order to tell you, hey, this is not being signed anymore. Don't even bother trying to install it because it's awful, right? Because the experience would be like, I built this whole like software catalog system for VirtualBuddy. So you have like a catalog, a library of versions of macOS you can install. And it would happen like it would take like an hour to download the 15 gigabyte IPSW only to then fail to install because Apple is no longer signing it. So now before it downloads it, it calls the server that I made and checks the signing state so that you don't have to bother trying to restore a virtual machine that will not work.
And couldn't you like filter the list like proactively? So like when the app is updating itself or something, like when it's installing, you can loop through the different versions of macOS that you have in the app and then check if they're still active, like before I've even clicked install, or is that like too resource intensive or it's not practical to do?
It would be, but there are ways I could do that. I could definitely have like a cache, right? And this would not even suffer from the famous cache invalidation issue, because once Apple stops signing a given build, it pretty much never starts signing it again. That just doesn't happen.
That would be strange.
For the security research device, they can do that, but that's another topic. But yeah, I do plan on doing that eventually. Basically have a little cache on... I already cache the build manifests on the server, but I also plan on caching the signing status so that I can not display versions that are not being signed. But that's not
right.
Not a huge issue, because it's rare that someone wants to install like an old version that's no longer signed. But it has happened a couple of times where I don't know if this was a mistake by Apple or something deliberate, but like a brand new macOS beta came out and they just were not signing it for virtual machines. I don't know. Maybe someone made a mistake somewhere, or they just didn't want to sign it for some reason.
Maybe it was some kind of security issue or anything else, something like that.
Yeah, could be. Or maybe just didn't work in the virtual machine. So yeah,
right.
For those cases, if that happens again, at least people will get a nice little warning in the app explaining exactly why they can't install that version.
Very nice. I like that you are kind of doing the kind of error messages and the kind of error handling you yourself wish that Xcode had, right? Like we just talked about how Xcode sometimes it just gives you an obscure error and no way to fix it, and you don't know how you're supposed to even, you know, begin to fix this thing. And these sort of things that you're building here, like this kind of like very user-friendly diagnostics, and you will tell the user exactly what's going on, like that is, I think that is a really good way of polishing an app, like to not just say an error occurred and that's it, but to like specifically say like, here's why the error occurred and here's how you could fix it, or here's why it's not worth trying again, right? Because right. Like a classic error message also would be to say, something went wrong, please try again. And then if the user would try again to install like the same macOS version that's not signed anymore like 50 times, it still wouldn't work because it's still not signed.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think adding these kinds of error messages is a great way to like polish a user experience.
Yeah, and I also do a lot of checking related to which features are supported by different versions, because it's quite complicated, the matrix, the support matrix, because you have things that are supported by the guest and things that are supported by the host. So you have the combination of both. For example, when they added iCloud support, so you can sign in with your iCloud account, and even like sign Xcode builds inside a virtual machine. When they added that, it was quite complicated because some people were trying, they installed like the first version of macOS that supported it in the virtual machine, but it wasn't working. And it was because their host Mac didn't support it, or vice versa. So you can see how I can get sometimes in the discussions on GitHub, and sometimes people don't even bother to say the versions of macOS, or they just say, I'm running macOS whatever, but like how do I know if that's the macOS you're trying to run in the virtual machine or the host or both? And of course, like some users are not very technical, so they don't even understand, like, I try to even avoid using terms like guest and host if I'm talking to someone and I don't know if they know that terminology. So I try to be very specific about those things. But yeah, in general, I think Apple has done a good job there. I think there, I could go on for hours about features I wish they'd offer, and maybe we'll get some of those at WWDC this year. And also, I really like how they are using virtualization to provide support for security research of private cloud compute.
Right, because there's this thing where you can get an image that you can then install virtually on your machine and kind of do security research on it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there, I mentioned how the virtual machine runs macOS like a real hardware. It has a boot ROM even that kind of mimics the boot ROM on your hardware. And they also have a boot ROM for the vResearch board, which is the board that runs the virtualized research environment. And that is quite special because that is not a macOS virtual machine. That is an iOS virtual machine.
That's interesting. So does that mean that you can create virtualized iPhones?
Well, that means you can.
And that probably means that you've already done it.
Exactly. Yeah, we have a link in the show notes. People probably saw it already on my Mastodon. But yeah, you can. So basically what's stopping everyone from just running a virtualized iPhone on their Mac is that Apple doesn't ship images for that, right? There is no right. IPSW for a virtual iPhone. So what I did was very complicated. I built a bunch of tooling that kind of takes the restore image from the private cloud compute image that Apple provides. It takes the restore image from an equivalent build of iOS for iPhone 16. And I used iPhone 16 because the virtualized iPhone environment that the system supports is an iPhone 16-ish virtual device. And it kind of meshes those together to create a restore image. And then I use custom software that I built that uses some private API in the virtualization framework to build a virtual machine with the right configuration, because it also has to emulate, but virtualize the Secure Enclave processor, which it also does for private cloud compute. So there's a bunch of configuration in the virtual machine, and it requires private entitlements. So to run that, I have to run the Mac with SIP disabled and with a bunch of boot arguments that disables a bunch of security stuff. So I would never recommend anyone do that. So basically, I did that. Then I rebooted my Mac and turned SIP back on because it's quite scary. Because it's basically settings that allow the Mac to run completely code with completely invalid code signatures, which is very,
right,
very dangerous. But yeah, I went through it quite quickly because we're running out of time, but it was a lot of work to get that working because I had to use the kernel image from the PCC image and the user space components from iOS. But the user space components from iOS expect certain things from the kernel that might not be there. And the worst part was a specific GPU driver component that was a dylib that is there on iOS but is not there on private cloud compute images. And you can't just copy from one to the other because that dylib is part of the shared DYLD cache. And right, I can't use the DYLD cache from private cloud compute because then it won't have UIKit and other things that iOS needs. So I basically reverse engineered that dylib and wrote my own in Xcode and built it and shoved it into the restore image. And that's how I got graphics to work, fully GPU accelerated graphics and all of that good stuff.
Makes it seem like the stuff that I was just talking about doing is super easy compared to what you've been doing here. Like it's like talk about low level. Like it doesn't get much more lower than that, low level than that, unless you're like building your own GPU or something.
Right. Yeah. And the tooling I had to, I mean, I didn't have to write the tooling to mash those two restore images together. But what I realized over several attempts is that if I do everything manually, not only is it a lot of work, but it's also extremely error prone.
Right, especially if you're like manually binary patching frameworks and caches and stuff like that.
Yeah, or even something as simple as changing something in the build manifest, which is a property list.
Yeah.
But it has very specific values you have to place in very specific keys. And there are also digests like SHA 384 digests that it needs. So I was like running SHA 384 in terminal, and but like if one bit is off, everything breaks. So you basically have to automate that stuff. So I wrote a tool that is called BuildBuddy, even.
Nice.
But it's a command line tool that basically does all of that work for me.
So what's the like iteration process like here? So you say like you get one thing wrong and everything breaks. Like what does everything break mean? Like does the virtual environment crash? Do you get an error message? Does your Mac kernel panic? Like how does all of these problems kind of manifest, and how do you iterate on them? Like what's the feedback loop like? When you get some kind of error like this, how do you fix it and how do you move on to like the next issue?
So you mentioned lots of potential problems, and the answer is all of the above. except for my Mac kernel panicking. That's actually quite rare.
Okay, that's good. That means that you at least always have like a layer to fall back on, right? Like you're not like, because you're virtualizing, you can always debug the virtualization instead of having to reboot in order to get a fresh state.
Right. So the first and most important step is to get the restore itself to work, which means that you have to figure out the right virtual machine configuration, the right combination of build manifest properties and components. There's lots of things. There's the TXM, the SPTM, the device tree. All of those things have to be right. And that's not particularly difficult because Apple ships those in the private cloud compute image. So you can take those and just use them almost as is. And you have to also remember to configure the virtual machine with some boot arguments so that the kernel has serial output. Because the only way I can see what's happening before the UI comes up in the virtual machine is looking at serial logs, which I configured the virtual machine with a serial device, and it just peels the serial output to console, to the terminal window. So that's the way you can basically see what's happening. But before you even get to that, you have to convince Apple signing service that you have a legitimate thing that you are using. And luckily, since we're talking about virtual machines, the service is a lot more lenient as to what it will support signing, basically. And with some specific configurations of virtual machine and build manifests, it will sign them. Because if I didn't do that, I would have to patch iBoot
right
to disable signing. And a bunch of things would break down the line as well. Because remember, everything in Apple's operating systems is based on this chain of trust that starts at the boot ROM and goes through different levels of iBoot to TXM, SPTM, the kernel, the secure enclave, and then to user land. So if you break anything in that chain, everything down the line breaks as well. So it's a nightmare, John.
I can imagine. And also, like, you don't want to do too much kind of manual patching, even if you could, because the whole point is also to create an environment that is like realistic to what you would have on a real device, whether it's like an iPhone device or a Mac OS environment. Like, if you create too many patches along the way and, you know, stub out too many of the systems, then, you know, kind of what's the point in the end?
Yeah, exactly. And they do, it's very similar with the real security research device. Out of the box, it's pretty much the same as a production device with very few differences at the kernel and TXM levels. Other than that, everything else is very similar to a production device, because if you want to do security research, you need an environment that reproduces what customers are using. If I disable all security, then how am I going to do security research, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're not reproducing any real life issues. Like, you're just like artificially creating issues at that point.
Right. But in this case, at least in the beginning, I was mostly just interested in seeing if I could get it to work. And just to mention, like, I'm not that special. Like, way more people have done this already. So it's not that I have the secret special knowledge. But yeah, I know of at least another two or three people who have done basically the same thing. One of them actually released a full guide, but their process is a lot more involved because they are patching everything, like I mentioned.
Right.
So it's a lot more involved, but you get a different result, and maybe that's what you want. You want everything to be patched. But yeah, the iteration, I got extremely familiar with the iOS device restore process, because I spent way too many hours looking at the Apple logo with a progress bar.
I can imagine. But it's really interesting how, you know, both of the two things we've talked about on this episode, like, they're very different, but they are all also have that shared theme of, I think both of us, we really want to understand how things work under the hood, and we really like playing around with things that are like lower level, that are not just like, you know, here is a library that you can use and let's go. Like, you know, you want to create something that is makes you fully understand the whole stack, whether it's the, you know, whole stack of an operating system or a whole rendering stack. Like, and I think in general, of course, like, when I'm working as a freelancer and working for clients, my mindset is very different. Like, there I'm more like using my time as efficiently as possible, solving the customer's problems, like implementing features, fixing bugs, you know, not playing around so much with stuff. But that's why I have my kind of secondary projects that I also allocate a certain amount of time every week for, like this project I talked about today, where I can more investigate and learn more about how things work under the hood. And I feel like that in general also helps me really evolve as a programmer. And it also helps kind of fuel my curiosity. And I think that the more you do things like that as a developer, the more you understand kind of the things you are building upon, right? As when you're building your applications, the kind of the big mountain of tech that you're standing on, like in terms of the tech stack, it really helps, I think. It helps demystify the computer. And it at least for me, it has really helped me gain a much broader understanding of all sorts of concepts, like when I'm doing programming. Like, I don't feel anymore that I'm just like an app developer, but more like, you know, I can actually work on any level of the stack, whether it's like building my own compiler or my own programming language or building my own UI framework or like drawing things, you know, completely custom on the GPU or anything else. Like, and I feel like that's, it's really liberating when you start feeling that way, that it's, you're not just like, I can, like the frameworks is not the limit to what I can create. I think that's, it's really cool.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully more people are able to do that. With AI these days doing a lot of the hard work for us, who knows what's going to happen, but at least we got to learn all of that stuff. And yeah, I doing all of this work, I learned so much stuff. And also knowing exactly how these things work really helps with security research, of course, but also day to day, like if I have some weird issue, sometimes it is related to that sort of thing, and it's good to know what's going on so that you can find a solution.
Yeah, exactly. And at the end of the day, also, you're having fun, right? And you feel like you're learning something and you're developing yourself as a programmer and you're finding new challenges to tackle, which, you know, this is always also a great goal in of itself.
That's the most important part.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so I think it's time to wrap up this episode of Stack Trace. So thanks so much for listening, everybody, and we will be back again next month. Be sure to reach out to us via either email or Blue Sky or Mastodon if you have any questions or there are any specific parts of what we talked about today that you would like us to dive deeper into on other upcoming episodes. But that's it for now, so all that remains is for you to say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.